Majority Report with Sam Cedar. It's time to look in the mirror, America. Do you like what you see?
I keep referring to Obama as the magic Negro.
Do you like what you see now?
Well, suck on this.
It's just a mirror, America.
Shared sacrifice by everybody.
What could it do to you except reflect your image?
I did nothing wrong at the Minneapolis airport.
The Majority Report.
Far more credible to me than PBS and Frontline.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
And I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Wednesday, September 23rd, 2015. My name is Matt Binder.
I'm Michael Brooks.
And this is the four-time award-winning The Majority Report. We are broadcasting to you live, steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal.
In the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On today's program, Josh Zepps, host at Huffington Post Live, host of We the People Live, Australian. Just thought I'd randomly throw that in. We're talking about the Pope's visit to the United States, the right-wing meltdown about the Pope's visit to the United States, the role of religion in public life. Scott Walker drops out. We're going to talk about why the pundits are always wrong. And was that evil pharma CEO that we talked about on the show yesterday, was he an outlier or an embodiment of American capitalism? All that and more with Josh Zepps, plus more news about Piggate, David Cameron's British Prime Minister and his experience with a pig. And now we discover that the leader of the opposition Labour Party, Jeremy Corbyn, has a very different history with pigs, and that history with pigs of both of these men tells you everything that you need to know. Plus new news from Saudi Arabia, get to that, possibly some Bernie Sanders news. Matt, what else we got?
The Pope is in America, folks, and boy is the right wing not happy.
Wah. Major wah. The Pope is just
that and much more
not who they want him to be. And it's really funny. Now, before we get to that, folks, I'm going to see if I can read this spot without doing a right-wing Gandhi or libertarian Gandhi impression. Because today's show is sponsored by a new PBS series, a new masterpiece series on PBS called Indian Summers. And it is a story of the Raj, which is, of course, the British rule of India, romance and revolution. Or as we say, a day in the life of Matt Binder, minus the Raj. But romance and revolution, certainly. And this series takes place in 1932 at the height of privilege was to be British in India, of course, because they ran and colonized the country. And the high point was the summer season at the hard-partying colonial retreat of Simla in the Himalayan foothills. Rude reality intrudes as cries for independence, for Indian independence, start to simmer. A rich caste representing British and Indian interests alternatively clash and conspire in intricate games of power, politics, and passion, or as we say, a day in the life of Sam Cedar. Intricate games of power, politics, and passion. Julia Waters, who I'm sure is an awesome actor, and a cast of Indian, British, and Pakistani actors star in this visually rich 9-part epic set in India during the twilight of British rule. I love that. I love a good – I just watched I think it was called An Honorable Woman with Maggie Gyllenhaal. That was pretty good. I had some questions about some of the politics of it, but that was – that 9-part series format is awesome. And then when you have a great global cast, I mean, you just know that this is going to be a great series. I'm looking forward to watching it. The sweeping new series premieres on Sunday, September 27th at 9 and 8, 9 Eastern, 8, 9/8C. I should know what that is, but I'm not totally sure. Yeah, 9 Eastern, 8 Central. Excuse me. I have no idea why I would forget that. On Masterpiece on PBS. And this is a twist on a period drama providing a window into both British and Indian perspectives. It's a 9-part series, and it's going to be a great doorway into the experience of that time, and with an amazing cast. We're going to throw an ad up to it, a 2-minute ad on our website at majority.fm. And I certainly look forward to watching that. And I look forward to talking with Josh Zepps. So without further ado, we're going to take a 20, 30, 40-second Chronics break. And I mean the music. And we'll be back with Josh Zepps on The Majority Report.
Eternal fire, dirty Babylon, you are gonna get bruised. Me, I want them fire. I said they just can't win, you're going to lose. We are want them. Ooh, yeah. I'm back up and warm. Me, I beg you, move. Yeah. I beg you, back up and warm. Me said that movement alive. Marcus said we organize and centralize. Rastafi own banks and enterprise. So me nah stop chanting my soul enter Zion. Princes of fire. Babylon me tell you your time just expire. What kind of wickedness me or your transpire? And no gasoline and a tire. Eternal fire. Not in Babylon you want to get bruised. Me I want them fire. I said they just can't win, you're going to lose. We are want them. Ooh, yeah. Ooh, yeah. I beg your papa and one. I tell you, ooh, yeah. Ooh, yeah. I tell your papa and one. Where them a go with a key and selfish way? Better them give me a key and garlic. That's right. Pass me a map and a compass on ya. Make me show them say selfish no come from on ya. That fish they come a far away. They bring him all the way from Norway.
I don't know if people noticed that, but when Chronics hit that note on Norway, Matt was harmonizing with him. I'm just playing. Welcome back to the Majority Report. I'm Michael Brooks.
What?
Joining us now is Josh Zepps. He's a host at HuffPost Live and the host of hashtag We The People Live, which is a great podcast that I've actually recently been on. Josh, great to have you on the show. How are you doing?
Am I the only person who didn't get that joke that you just made about the high note?
I think, you wouldn't get it.
Do we all not know what you were talking about?
Basically, you don't get it, and the victim...
And none of the listeners get it.
No, the listeners get it.
Everyone's very confused. People are turning off in droves. I don't know why I'm even... Why are we even talking here?
I was the subject of the joke, and I don't even get it.
But that's usually the case
exactly.
With you.
Well, I'm glad. Sometimes I'm unaware of certain types of certain American humorous tropes as a result of my being Australian. I'm pleased to know that is not, I'm not at fault now. It is just Michael's bizarre sense of humor that nobody understands.
Michael's weird, so yeah.
Well, yeah. Right, yeah, and this led to a great, really entertaining one-minute interlude. No, but you know, I don't hold it against you. Either of you.
Good. Well, there's nothing to hold again.
Yeah.
Which is great. So we're both in agreement.
Matt doesn't get it.
And thank you for promoting my wonderful new podcast where three entertaining people sit around in a bar in Brooklyn and talk about the news. Who wouldn't want to hear such a thing?
It's actually really fun.
We the People Live. Just follow it at WTP _ live. Can you believe someone else has WTP Live?
What do they do?
I don't even know. I didn't bother to look, but my producer told me.
Huh. I really wonder what that show is. Or if it was just some,
or if
like...
Or it even is a show. Or what if it's just an acronym for, like, whiskey, token, person, lamb, llama, indigo, Victoria Echo.
I would listen to that show.
The company.
I would subscribe to that show or buy that product in a heartbeat.
Sure.
Absolutely.
You can also go to WTPLive.com. That's the easy way to go to our website.
You've certainly learned the American way of self-promotion, brother.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I figure,
you're good on that.
Get out of the way up front, because here's what happens. We're going to get all carried away
right.
with all of the entertaining things that are going on in the United States of America right now.
Right.
And then all of a sudden, it's going to be the end of the show, and I'm going to hang up and go, oh, you know what I forgot to do? I forgot to plug my own show.
That's a fair point. I've been there. It is a really good show. I had a really fun time being on it, and
I
audience.
I enjoyed it, and also Sam was on it as well. Sam Cedar was on it.
Right, he was on that
one time on a different show, on a different episode.
Yeah, you
so
can pretty much.
All of your listeners should clearly be going to WTPLive.com right now, and downloading it.
We actually got, there were some listeners who, when he was on and when I was on, there were some like, hey, it was great to see. You know, two people from one of my favorite podcasts show up on another one of my favorite podcasts. So some of that overlap already exists. So we'll keep building on it. So look, I want to get to the Pope because I think that, you know, it raises a lot of interesting questions. And I know a conversation that you and I have is this sort of all of these debates about secularism, atheism, religion, the role of religion in modern life. And I think that the Pope is a really fascinating figure because obviously he's upsetting the right a lot because, and ironically, because he's actually just sort of giving a robust articulation and support of Catholic doctrine when as applied to social justice issues, development issues, and environmental issues, but clearly also his tone and his sort of points of emphasis are, I guess, what we're associating now or calling left, which is sort of another conversation. I mean, I think they are left, but I think they're also pretty commonsensical. So how do you, before we sort of broaden the conversation, as a pretty secular-oriented guy, what do you think about the Pope in this? In certain areas? Obviously, we'll get to areas of criticism of him when it, as regards to sexuality, gender, and you know, contraception, those issues. But certainly on the issues that he's mainly speaking about, I mean, would you think he's actually kind of a progressive voice in today's
world?
Well,
it's interesting. It's interesting the low bar that we have for people, for religious people, right? I mean, he's progressive within the context of believing a bunch of batshit crazy things that were written down thousands of years ago before people understood the germ theory of disease or that the Earth went around the sun. So he's good. But we always, and we do this with Islam all the time as well, and you and I talk about this a lot, we set a very, very low bar. You know, we talk about how, you know, in Indonesia, the Muslims are stoning adulteresses all over the place. Well, okay, good for them. If you remove religion from the equation, we wouldn't expect that to be a good thing, to be an admirable thing, the mere absence of stoning adulteresses. So I kind of feel the same way about the Pope. It's good. Good to have him on side. Better him than one of his really conservative cardinals being Pope and telling everyone, then constantly banging on about how terrible abortion is and how horrible gay people are.
Right.
But, you know, let's not get carried away. I think it is interesting, though, that the people who love the Pope the most are secular people, and the people who hate him the most are American Christians.
Well, like, that's, I mean, and there's liberal people.
Conservative American Christians.
There's liberal people in the Catholic Church who are quite happy that that there's a sort of push to left. But before we get into that bigger conversation, I mean, the thing, though, that strikes me, that, again, and this is one of these things, whether we like it or not, we could just sort of say, okay, whatever, religion's just these sort of ancient discredited dogmas. I know that that's your view, but I think the thing that's also interesting about the Pope, and it is, again, whether we like it or not, it is coming from this Catholic tradition and all that it encompasses, is that it's not just that he's saying the right thing on poverty or global warming. He's trying to, and again, obviously from a religious tradition which gives and it takes, very much so, but he's trying to articulate a different ethic and a different frame of reference for what the priorities should be in today's world, right? So he's kind of calling back to people who I would be in that Catholic tradition, but a guy like, you know, E.F. Schumacher or you know, people who wrote about alternative economics and different ways of structuring institutions in society and saying there has to be something that supersedes the profit motive, right? That's run amok. And there's secular critiques of that, obviously. But religion is still a major force in the world. And we're having a guy who is turning that around and using a usually, I would accept, a pretty regressive force in not only a progressive direction, but a reorienting direction. And it seems to me that that challenge is stronger than just simply like, oh, well, at least he's not doing bad.
In the context of the fact that there are 1.2 billion Catholics, I agree with you. In the context of the fact that we're not going to have everyone turn around and become an enlightened secular agnostic overnight. That being said,
they can't all be me, man.
I think you also have to think about, you've said a couple of times now the Catholic tradition. This is really part of an internal civil war within a strand of different Catholic traditions,
definitely,
right?
And
that's the case in all religions. You know, whenever anyone says something that's a generalization about Islam as well, people get jumped on and say, well, it's a very long and, you know, there's no similarity between Sunnis and Shias and Sufis and so on, and that's true. In the same way, within Catholicism, there is an American tradition of quite conservative Catholicism, which is sort of in parallel to American evangelical Protestantism, which gets hung up a lot on birth control, on abortion, on these social issues. But actually, outside of the United States, Catholicism is not traditionally one of the more conservative strains of Christianity.
Right.
You know, especially the South American strain that this Pope comes from.
Right.
It's concerned a lot less with dogma and a lot more with living your life in the image of Jesus and, you know, being humble and helping the poor and so on. So I think the fact that he comes from that tradition is what really is going on here. It's less about reorienting the church and it's more about one faction within the church becoming ascendant because the current leader of the institution comes from that particular frame.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. And a thing that I really do appreciate all, you know, and I know we have some pretty rigorous disagreements on this stuff and it's fun to sort of debate it in person and on shows and everything else. But one thing that I really do appreciate and I agree with you on is that whatever your perspective is on all this stuff, you have to understand that these traditions, not from like a politically correct mealy-mouth perspective, but just from the perspective of knowing what you're talking about, that there's major internal debates in all of these things and there's political factions and jockeying like anything else. And I think you're really nailing it because this sort of shift really from and a sort of European dominated and this sort of Italian faction, German faction of the church versus, you know, a Latin American pope coming in with all of that entails, that is a very potent political shift. And I think people who know about Latin America, they know that not only is the Catholic Church more left-wing there in some respects, there's even been, you know, there's Catholics who are well to the left of this pope when you start talking about things like liberation theology. And then you really start seeing this sort of like manifested as almost kind of revolutionary Marxist politics. But I mean, before we sort of the kind of big takeaway, or I guess maybe this is the smaller takeaway, but the sort of immediate significance of this trip, do you think that this is just kind of a no win for Republicans? I mean, because they can, you know, by bashing him, and by getting so overtly hostile to him, it seems to me that what they're doing is they're stripping away another institution or another kind of moral reference point for sanctifying their nonsense. You know, it's like Rick Santorum's been running around for years saying, well, you know, it's not that I hate gay people. It's not that I'm a bigot. It's not all this nonsense. It's because there is this sacred vessel that I'm committed to. And it's like, well, wait a second. Now, all of a sudden, guys like that, you know, who's the cafeteria Catholic now? Right? Is it somebody
right.
who
but,
says?
I mean, but
yeah.
what is yeah. their option, Michael? I mean, they yeah. back themselves into a corner by holding positions that are so far outside the global mainstream. I mean, you know, Republicans have to go on the attack against the Pope because he's such a clear and vocal repudiation of everything that they believe.
Yep.
You know, they can't take it lying down. So yes, I agree that it's basically lose-lose for them. And increasingly, the Republican Party is just becoming a rump that appeals only to white, aging, racist, and evangelical Protestants for whom abortion and persecuting gays are the number one issues, and everything else takes a back seat. I mean, if that is your audience, then it plays well to go hard against a Pope who airs a vision of religion that's less theocratic than your own.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And I guess the big takeaway from that before we pivot is really just Obama is just like, yeah, how do you like them apples? Lose, lose. Suck it.
any opportunity to get your surprisingly good Obama impression in on the air.
Nothing. Well, first part is true. Second part is false. There's nothing surprising about it. But yes, I will bank shot an Obama impression shamelessly and with no embarrassment whatsoever. And to quote Donald
Trump.
Well, because and to quote Donald Trump, it's because the people love it. It's a fantastic impression. Mm-hmm. It's a fabulous impression.
Mm-hmm.
It's an excellent impression. It's huge.
Oddly
enough, I cannot
like
do a
losers.
Trump impression. Yeah, if they don't like it, you're a loser. Absolutely.
Losers.
You can kind of do a Trump impression.
Well, I sort of just invoke my inner id and my just as long as I get the ego up to a certain point, you just can't help it. Can't help it.
you know what it is though? It's like we're doing a tenth of it. Like,
yeah, that's true.
You're talking
that's
about.
True. I would be able to do a good Trump. I do good impressions once I work on them. That's what I used to do. That's how I started out in Australia. You know, I started out as a radio satirist, doing impersonations of political figures. If I put my mind to it, I would nail a Trump.
I buy it. I think we should both be working on that because he's not going away. And but let's.
I think he's going away.
Oh, you do? Well, actually, then let's go to that for a minute. I'll explain to you why. I want to know why you think he is. But on this show, the three of us have been bullish about Trump from the beginning for a couple of reasons. One, we think he's the perfect embodiment of the Republican Party. All of these people have been being told for ages that the sort of pinnacle of human achievement is being a rich asshole. Boom. He's got it. And he speaks without – he gives you the subtext. And, you know – I just saw another poll this morning where it's like he's still crushing it in Iowa. And it starts to look more to me like every time they say he fades, you know, he's in the Mitt Romney position right now in 2012. Everybody else is just running up against him. He always, at the end of the day, is still fundamentally leading. Now, whether or not he wants to drop out or even really wants it is another question. But he's been real resilient. So why do you think now is the time that he's done?
I've also been bullish on him from the start. I've always been skeptical of the political insiders who say, oh, he's going to be a flash in the pan, he'll go away. And I've always said, well, you say that, but by what mechanism does he go away? He doesn't need anyone's money.
Right.
He continues to appeal. Tell me how he goes away. And I think I saw a glimmer of it at this most recent Republican debate, which is what has changed my mind. And now I'm a bit more sober about the Trump phenomenon. There are a couple of things I would mention. One is, as Howard Feinman, my sort of boss, quasi-boss, pointed out, because he's the editorial director of the Huffington Post Media Group, and I speak to him at least once a week on Health First Live, Trump has been number one for 2 weeks longer than Michelle Bachmann was.
Mm-hmm.
Just bear that in mind, in terms of how long he's been number one. Secondly, I've been always wondering, what is it, and a lot of the pundits have been wondering, what is it that Trump could say that would alienate the Republican base? Because he's already said every possible offensive thing. Right?
But they that stuff.
Exactly.
Yes.
So there's nothing that people have been scratching their heads going, how does he implode? He can't implode because every time he says something more outrageous, he only becomes more popular.
Right.
Well, I think we got a vision of how at the last Republican debate, which is, he may implode not with a bang, but with a whimper. Because the moment the conversation started turning towards foreign policy, the moment Carly Fiorina got in a dig about Trump not having known who the Iranian Quds Force was when he was interviewed by Hugh Hewitt on his popular conservative radio show, which was a huge deal to be eviscerated by Hugh Hewitt on foreign policy.
But Hugh Hewitt backed down. Hugh Hewitt backed down. He backed down like a little punk.
What he ended up doing, what Trump ended up looking like on the debate stage was someone with nothing to say. And I think that's a bigger liability than him putting his foot in his mouth, which is clearly impossible.
Right.
So I think that, yeah, he might win Iowa. He might even win New Hampshire. He's not going to win South Carolina. I mean, black people vote in South Carolina.
Not in Republican primaries.
Well, enough of them do that it can be problematic. I suspect.
So if it comes down to like an actual numeric, like 30 vote difference, literally 30 people, the black vote in the South Carolina primary will tip it.
Well, perhaps. I suspect that the only way that he stays around is if he launches an independence campaign. Because I think he's not going to get the Republican nomination. I would have. I wouldn't have said that 2 weeks ago, but I'd be willing to put money on it now.
So I think you're on point with that. And actually, I would predict, because I don't even know the sort of question mark for me has always been if he even really wants it. And that's something we've talked about, too.
Yeah,
but I
exactly.
think. I think, though, that what is a very possible scenario is I think he will. I think he is going to win Iowa, New Hampshire. I think he'll do. I think he's going to win some primaries. And I think because the Republican Party and the establishment is trying to destroy him, and they're using Carly Fiorina as like some type of like robotic, you know, suicide bomber almost to try to like take him out. You know, they're throwing everything at him that they possibly can. But I think if he starts to perceive it, because the thing about Donald Trump that's so amazing is like, you know, and I'll tell me if you agree with this, but I think like as an example if and there's no reason why Obama would have done this, but if in 2009 Barack Obama said, you know, Donald Trump is going to be the co-chair of my recovery commission because he's the best CEO America's ever seen, he's fantastic and he's huge and he does great deals and he's amazing. Like, Donald Trump would have spent the next six years explaining that Barack Obama was the best president in U.S. history, right? Like, he's racist, he's got all this stuff, but ultimately he is such a raw narcissist that it's all about – so if he feels in any way personally disrespected or slighted by the Republican establishment, and you see it, he's starting up at Fox again, he will run as an independent, and he'll do something. I mean, because that – there is a block of people that – he is speaking right to their gut, emotionally.
Oh, if he runs as an independent, then there is absolutely no chance for the Republican to win. I mean, I already think that there's no chance for the Republican to win unless it's Marco Rubio, just because of the demographics. You know, Marco Rubio would be a long shot, but at least he'd put Florida in the bag, and there's no way they can win without Florida.
Right.
And he would counteract the sort of countervailing demographic that are so bad for the Republicans. I mean, as I think I've mentioned before, but your listeners will probably like to be reminded, if the Democrats get the same share of the non-white vote in 2016 as Obama did in 2012, then the Republican will have to get a larger share of the white vote than any non-incumbent Republican candidate ever has in the history of the United States. You know, how does that happen when you're talking with all this rhetoric about building a wall and all this hate mongering against Latinos? I don't see how any Republican can make the math work.
I think you're absolutely right. I mean, you know, Marco Rubio, when he talks, sometimes in a debate, he's a little bit of a children of the corn thing going on when he talks about foreign policy. But I think that, I see what you're saying. I think the trouble with Marco Rubio is I just don't know if he has. He's already had to twist himself into a lot of knots to survive being, you know, getting through a Republican primary and being palpable in a general. And I think that while he does have, you know, he has higher than average chops, certainly than the normal sort of modern Republican candidates, I don't think he's quite adroit or talented enough to pull off that level of sort of operating and throwing two messages at the same time.
Depends who he's up against.
No, I mean, I think even to get through the primary, I think would just be very hard for him.
But you mean even to just to win the primary?
Yeah, I think it's just difficult.
I mean, he may also be slightly too reasonable for Republican primary voters. But if they, I mean, if it depends whether or not primary voters are going to be caring about who's going to win, who can win the general, or whether they're just going to be going on their usual course of trying to, you know, select the most conservative candidate. It's tricky to know.
So let's get before, because I want to touch on two other real quick things with you before we wrap up. And I think just like the last kind of note on the Republicans is, you know, Scott Walker is gone with even less than a whimper. And I mean, there's someone whose career, like this election has ended so pathetically that a guy that, you know, I totally detest, who represents everything that is wrong in America in many respects. It was, I even felt like a sort of glimmer of pity versus compassion, but I will say some pity for him. But I guess the thing that's relevant in our business, and I think even someone, like I think I was saying this, you know, several months ago before this actually started, like on paper, Scott Walker is a pretty formidable Republican primary candidate. People just got this totally wrong.
Totally amazing. I mean, I was in Greece covering the financial crisis during the week of the of the Greek referendum. When was that? That was probably about 8 weeks ago. Yep. My friend over there, who's a journalist, was picking my brain about who I thought was the most popular. And I was like, there's no way that Jeb's going to get it. So
definitely.
I guess that's at least Scott Walker as being the favorite. I mean, how wrong could I have been?
Yeah.
He's just done a really impressively terrible job.
Yeah.
I mean, he was so bad in that first debate. He was like Rick Santorum without the charm. And Rick Santorum has no charm. Like, I'm amazed at how badly Scott Walker's done. I don't think I recall a descent from a lowering of expectations as swiftly as Scott Walker's. It's baffling. I'm impressed.
It's dizzying. I guess that's all there is to say about it. And the final thing I want to run by you is I'm sure you've been talking about it too, but we've been talking about this, you know, this total dirtbag, this guy Martin Shkreli, the farmer CEO, who's, you know, I guess now he's backtracking a little bit. He's saying he's not going to raise the price of this vital AIDS drug by 5,000%, which was the initial number that he had tagged on it. But the thing is that and I really want to get your thought on this before we wrap up. Every time something like this happens, and it's quite easy, and we've done it ourselves on this show, because this guy certainly, you know, it's what he's done, it's his manner. I mean, he does come off like a total sociopath and a sort of like uniquely unethical and repulsive person. But when we fixate on a symptom, are we losing sight of, while this is a radical and extreme example, how different is this from kind of rampant price gouging across pharma itself? And frankly, in some ways, you know, if you're watching Fox Business or something, isn't this guy just like doing capitalism? So it's so weird that we,
saying? We are focusing too much on him as an individual, and the pharmaceutical industry knows it. I read a piece on the website of the pharmaceutical industry by a commentator who was sort of slapping his forehead and saying, oh God, this is only going to bring more attention to our misdeeds. Every time something like this happens, it gets the press and politicians agitated. Even Hillary tweeted about it, saying that she's going to do something to address it. But I did a segment on this yesterday morning on HuffPost Live, and I had Dr. Ezekiel Emanuel on it, Zeke Emanuel, who was one of the architects of Obamacare, and who was one of Obama's White House advisors, who now heads up health policy at UPenn. And he was saying that these are the things that we need the catalysts to be to get some action on controlling the price of drugs. But the United States is the only country in the world, in the rich world, the only developed country that has no mechanism for regulating the price of drugs. I mean, in countries like Australia and Canada, where you have Medicare for all, there's a pharmaceutical benefits body, which is just a panel of experts that say, that analyze the benefits and the downsides of drugs, and they make recommendations, and they say that this is what Medicare is going to pay, and this is what it's not going to pay, and we don't think that the drug is worth more than that, and with a finite amount of money to spend, we're not going to spend it. And you know what? Drug companies cop it. They don't go bankrupt. They don't go broke. They still sell the drugs for reasonable prices.
They're still able to innovate. They're still able to innovate. They might just have a smaller bonuses and a smaller ad budget, which is where all this money goes to.
The whole innovation argument is almost always BS. So, for example, here's one example. Gilead Sciences, they developed two Hep C drugs, Sovaldi and Harvoni, less than 2 years ago. They have already recouped all of the R&D expenses for the development of those two drugs. Do you think they're bringing the prices down to cheap levels? Of course not. Right. They're going to keep on charging as high a price as they possibly can for these drugs, and they will in perpetuity, and they'll justify it by saying, well, I mean, the American consumer has to pay these high prices so that we can afford the innovation and the research and development on other drugs. Well, that's exactly the same bullshit that this guy was saying when he raised the price of that drug by 5,000%. He said that we want to find a better drug. Every doctor I've spoken to says there's no need to find a better drug because the drug that he just jacked the price up on already does a perfectly good job.
Exactly. It's like, well, we'll privatize your water supply and jack it up to find something better at hydrating you. I mean,
there has to be action on this. There has to be some kind of – I mean, the worst thing that ever happened in the healthcare debate was all the rhetoric about death panels. We need death panels. We need panels that are able to say this is worth spending money on and that is not worth spending money on. If you could extend grandma's life by one day in a coma, in a hospital bed where she's not even aware of it at a cost of $1 trillion. Would that be worth it? Would that seriously be worth it, $1 trillion for one more day in a coma? Clearly not. So we have to start making decisions about what we want to spend money on and what we don't want to spend money on. And part of that has to do with what we're willing to, what kind of price we're willing to pay for which particular types of drugs.
Yeah, but
otherwise, healthcare is just going to absorb the entire U.S. economy.
Well, that's exactly right. But also, not only that, I mean, if we actually did a process like that, the primary sort of where the fat would be cut would not be on life extension and health, because first of all, we also already know another major part of this conversation is the complete lack of emphasis placed on prevention and healthy lifestyles and the things that actually could fundamentally lead to, increasing lifespan, lowering medical costs. But the other sort of, but when we actually did an actual process where we attacked these treatments and it was done properly and just about actual efficiencies, it would come down on pharma. It would come down on the insurance industry. I mean, when we're talking about things like HMOs and insurance, these are completely unnecessary and parasitic industries to begin with. But I think the takeaway from this segment here, though, is that in some ways, Martin Treckley is almost like the Donald Trump of the pharma industry, and that by being so obscene, he's revealing the true nature of this business and giving us a roadmap for all the radical reforms we need. So I guess thanks, Martin. I mean, I still think he should probably be in jail, but thank you.
Yeah, and I would just add also, it's a common trope on the left to blame HMOs and insurance companies. Insurance companies' margins are actually surprisingly slim. The real cost of American healthcare comes from pharmaceutical companies, drug companies, medical device manufacturers, hospitals, and actually doctors. They're harder to beat up on, but that's actually the people who are.
Well, I think that's true in terms of the prices, but I think where the beef with HMOs and insurance companies are, first of all, that's who you're primarily dealing with, who's denying you care, as an example. And then secondly, we know that, you know, you mentioned Medicare for all systems before. There isn't going to be a system in the world that doesn't exist, obviously, without doctors, medical devices, or drug companies. The necessity of having these mediating agents is highly suspect. So I think it's not the profit margins. It's the immediate role they play in screwing people over. And then, well, why do we even need you to begin with that triggers people so much? But I think, you're absolutely right about the spending margins. Josh, it's always a pleasure, man. It's great. I'm sure we'll do many of these things on all fronts soon.
Anytime. Please. Great to speak to you. If people like me, then follow WTP_live on Twitter. Find hashtag WeThePeopleLive on iTunes or SoundCloud and go to WTPLive.com.
And there's a link to it on majority.fm. It really is a great podcast, and it's great talking with you, man. Take care. Be well. See you soon.
Wonderful to talk to you. See you, mate. Cheers. All right, bye.
All right, everybody. That was a lot of fun.
Let's get to this. So the Pope has landed in America. And if you were watching Fox News the other day, during their coverage of the Pope's coming to America, you might have heard something quite odd, almost out of place for Fox News, from one Shep Smith.
I think we're in a weird place in the world when the following things are considered political. Five things. I'm going to tick them off. These are the five things that were on his and our president's agenda. Caring for the marginalized and the poor, that's now political. Advancing economic opportunity for all, political. Serving as good stewards of the environment. Protecting religious minorities and promoting religious freedom globally. Welcoming and integrating immigrants and refugees globally. And that's political. I mean, I don't know what we expect to hear from an organization's leader like the Pope of the Catholic Church, other than protect those who need help, bring in refugees who have no place because of war and violence and terrorism. These seem like universal truths, that we should be good to others who have less than we do, that we should give shelter to those who don't have it. I think these were the teachings in the Bible of Jesus. They're the words of the Pope, they're the feelings of the president, and people who find themselves on the other side of that message should consult a mirror, it seems like, because I think that's what we're supposed to do as a people, whatever your religion. I mean, it seems to me, and I think to probably, as Bill O'Reilly would put it, most clear-thinking Americans, that's how we're supposed to roll.
Well, I don't know about that last part with Bill O'Reilly, but wow, Shep Smith, I'm truly impressed. I mean, it's amazing that you would think those things, because Media Matters has put together a little compilation. And I know you said, you know, you should look in the mirror, but maybe you should look in the other studios in your building, the other offices, the people in front of the other cameras, the people behind the cameras, the people in the upper echelons of the office. You should really go visit them, because this is what they, and I'll grant these are all not Fox News talkers, but a lot of them are, and this is what they have to say about the Pope and what the Pope's been saying.
Will Francis and Barack reshape the world by taxing the rich, taxing fossil fuels, and redistributing the wealth? That's exactly what they're trying to do.
He talks about the horror of capitalism. He's anti-trickle-down economics. He supports the Iranian deal.
His job is to get souls into heaven, period. His job is not to tell governments how to spend money.
This is just pure Marxism coming out of the mouth of the Pope. There's no such unfettered capitalism that doesn't exist anywhere.
Essentially, he's talking about the greed of America.
Is this an anti-capitalist Pope?
The Pope sounds like he is against capitalism.
He has a Marxist background.
This Pope is a world government promoting, anti-gun, global government, carbon tax guy, and it's sick.
The same people who gave us Obama gave us this Pope.
Do you think he's going to get political at all and talk about America's worship of money and our green energy and talk about global warming?
The most dangerous person on the planet is somebody who's seeking strange new respect from their adversaries. And that is what the Pope is doing.
We are not bamboozled by a clean white outfit and a huge cross.
I've asked the Pope's people if I could put together a team of people that could actually teach the Pope.
He comes out of a Latin American strand of Catholicism that is, frankly, sort of anti-capitalist and anti-bourgeois.
Go visit the Pope and say, this is what capitalism is.
We're not buying this big lie.
He is a Malthusian.
Does this Pope understand America?
The Pope is saying we have to give and give and give, the rich. We have to give and give and give until we're all poor.
And I think it's up to the Catholic people to turn their backs on this Pope before it is too late, before they wake up and find out that they're in chains.
You have a Pope doing this at this point and calling for a planetary government.
He doesn't want to be your grandfather's Pope. He wants to be a modern Pope. All he needs is dreadlocks and a dog with a bandana, and he could be on Occupy Wall Street.
The Pope is a danger to the world.
And as far as I'm concerned, this Pope needs an exorcism.
The interesting thing is, people don't recall this, but in 2012, right-wing talker is absolutely right. The same people who brought us Obama brought us this Pope. In 2012, a bunch of bishops got together. And if you recall, they said if the smoke comes up and it's white, it's Mitt Romney. If the smoke comes up and it's black, it's Barack Obama. And that's how America picked the president. I mean, this is just amazing. I love how Glenn Beck was like, I had my people contact the Pope's people, and we were like, let's teach you on this stuff. Like, it's just amazing. So, Shep Smith, maybe you should contact some of your colleagues and find out how many of them agree with you on what you think the Pope should be talking about. Because maybe you could hand them a Bible and tell them to read it.
We are going to get into the fun half in just a moment. Before I do that, I actually need to tell you again about today's sponsor. Matt, am I doing an okay job plugging this show?
You're doing a decent job of plugging the show.
How could I make it a better job plugging the show?
Sound like you're listening to a Chronic song live.
Well, that would just be inauthentic.
Like, I need you to completely...
That would be inauthentic. Do you want to put some Chronics on underneath me while I read this ad?
No.
By the way, that joke about you have harmonized with Chronics at certain times when you're more peppy.
Sometimes.
And I thought that was just an idea of you sort of like coming in for the Norway line was funny. Okay, look. Everybody knows that the Majority Report primarily relies on you, our members for support. So become a member today at majority.fm/member. Less than a cup of coffee today. Less than a cup of coffee a day. Be our boss. Become a member. Do you like the sound of that? But we've been having some ads recently, a lot of ads, and some of these are for things that are really good and really exciting. And yes, it may not be Chronics, but this actually sounds like an amazing series, Indian Summers, which is going to be on PBS, and it's Raj, Romance, and Revolution. And it's a new masterpiece series on PBS, a twist on period drama, providing a window into both the British and Indian experience during this time. And the time is 1932, at the height of privilege, where the height of privilege was to be British in India. This is during the sort of, you know, the revolutionary rumblings of India, but there's still British control. And these British colonialists would go and party in the colonial retreat of Simla in the Himalayan foothills. I've seen pictures of Simla. I haven't been to India yet, but it is an unbelievably beautiful place just visually. And I know people who visited Simla, and it is – so just visually, this series is going to be spectacular. But in this series, Indian Summer, rude reality intrudes as cries for Indian independence start to simmer. A rich caste representing British and Indian interests alternatively clash and conspire in intricate games of power, politics, and passion. Julie Waters and a cast of British, Indian, and Pakistani actors star in this visually rich 9-part epic set in India during the twilight of British rule. The new series premieres Sunday, September 27th on Masterpiece on PBS. And I'm going to watch it. We have an ad for it. I'm going to throw on the website. Really, really excited about this show. That is a fascinating time in history. It's something that implicates all of our conversations. So Indian Summers on PBS, going to be fascinating. We'll post the link right after the show on the website. And, you know, touches everything, politics, class, romance, and the rise of a nation. I'm going to get on the phones. We're going to take some calls. We're going to get to some quick stories, and we will see everybody on the flip side, unless you're a non-member and you're not listening to this live. In that case, we won't see you on the flip
but
side.
But we could.
We could.
If you go to majority.fm and click become a member,
yep,
and for less than a cheap cup of coffee a day, you can subscribe to the show, support independent media, get bonus content. It's a win-win-win. And if you can't do that, then the least you could do is when you buy your junk through Amazon, you could go to MajorityReportKickback.com and buy it through our link there. It is the same Amazon page you will see if you just went to Amazon, except this version of the link forces Amazon's hand into reaching into their pockets, pulling out their very large wallet, going into the little change department, and pulling out a few pennies for us.
That's right.
Which, when enough people do, becomes a little clue.
It becomes something.
Yeah.
And really quickly, everybody, you'll be finding more about this tomorrow, but we're launching another show. It's going to be a sports show, sport and culture show, hosted by my friend Brian Rich. Called Sportsocracy. Really, really excited about that. So stay tuned. That's a result of the Indiegogo campaign and the larger Majority plan to sustain and grow this show and shows like it.
And the way you can support that show
the
show is to subscribe on iTunes.
And write us a review.
It's very important. When that show goes up, do it for that show. While you're waiting for that show to go up, though, you can do it for our show today.
All right, everybody. We will see you on the fun half. We'll get right to the phone lines. I see two callers waiting. Say to